Brennan's killing to, quote, tragic circumstances. Colonel Gabovics was a key source in the DeZatteo documentary, Who Killed Shireen? This is Diane Nissenbaum interviewing him when he was still anonymous.
Would you say that the Biden administration failed Shireen Abu Akleh?
I would say so. He should have absolutely come forward and actually pressed the fact that an American citizen was killed intentionally by IDF.
For more, we are joined by retired Colonel Gabovics in Washington, D.C. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Colonel Steve Gabovics. You are speaking out after Zatteo for the first time in this global radio television broadcast. If you can talk about what your involvement was exactly in the investigation of the killing of this American journalist, leading Palestinian-American journalist on Al Jazeera, known around the world, tell us how you came to be involved with the case and how you investigated it.
Absolutely. Good morning. So I was at the time, I was the chief of staff for the Office of the United States Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian Authority. So we had interactions on a regular basis with the Palestinian Authority security forces, and then also the government of Israel and the IDF. When Shireen Abu Akleh was killed on May 11, 2022, it immediately became a large concern for the United States to try to figure out what had happened for this. On that same day, we started looking, okay, what can we possibly do for an investigation into her killing? Because there were reports initially that it was by a Palestinian gunman. There was no reports initially that it was by an IDF, at least not from the Israeli side. And the ambassador at the time asked our office, just because of the relationships we had, to talk to the FBI and see if they'd be possibly, that they could do an interview, do an investigation into her killing. At that point in time, we waited for the FBI to get back like a day or two, and they came back and said that we cannot do so. The government of Israel has not asked us to, and does not appear to be an act of terrorism. As such, they did not have jurisdiction. After this determination was made, Lieutenant General Fenzel talked with Ambassador Nides, and indicated that we had law enforcement capacity, trained individuals within the USSC, myself being at that point in time 27 years as a military police officer, as well as other members from different nations that were part of the USSC. So since there was no one else to do that investigation inquiry, I was tasked to lead that on behalf of the embassy to look into the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. Once that was initially determined, we started looking at all the different evidence that existed from every type of communications that were there, video, sound recordings. Immediately went out and met with the Attorney General for the Palestinian Authority. We had one of our other officers go and meet with the IDF, the Central Command G3, to get a rundown of what had happened that day and how their forces were aligned. And we started to see the different things happening in the media at the same point in time. So we continued to build up our capacity and understanding of the event before we went out actually to the site and put ourselves in position to see what actually happened on the ground, knowing what the disposition was of the Israeli forces and knowing exactly the timing and location of Shireen Abu Akleh and the rest of the journalist crew that was out there that morning.
So just to set that scene, May 11, 2022, she's outside with a team of journalists, the Jenin refugee camp, clearly wearing that press vest and a helmet. So the vest goes up near to her neck. You've got the helmet. So you have to really aim to get her in the neck. So explain what your conclusion was, who you were allowed to speak to, who you were prevented from speaking to, and what was the Israeli military unit in charge there on the ground at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. So after we reviewed all the video evidence, we looked at the autopsy as well and where the bullet had struck her. When we went out to the ground, we wanted to see exactly what type of aiming that the sniper had in relation to his targets and verify whether or not he would have had the ability to see Shireen Abu Akleh and the rest of the media crew walking down the middle of the street. So when we went out there, the day was basically the same thing as exactly it was on May 11th. Beautiful sunny day, clear as could be, no obstructions from where the IDF sat at 190 meters away down to where Shireen Abu Akleh was at and where she was actually shot. and a clear view also down to the road where they had actually staged to start their movement up there to do recordings of, you know, what was going on with the IDF interactions that day. We looked at not only the video first to see the different shots that were fired and how they were fired. You know, Al-Samoudi was shot first, and then there was a break in between, and then it was Shireen Abu Akleh who was shot. And we went to the location of the carob tree. We looked at the bullet holes themselves. There were three actually in the carob tree. One obviously hit her as well. And we saw where other ones had hit between the video. All the shots that were at the carob tree and where she was hit in the head were aim shots in a very tight group, which means that they were aimed for headshots at that location. You could see it very easily. From there, we walked up the street to the location where the IDF was set. When they were there on May 11th, they actually had armored vehicles, five armored vehicles, two that were perpendicular to the road. So they had protective fire to the north and south, and then three that were in the middle. They were the extraction team for the element that had conducted the raid in Jenin itself. From there, we had representatives from the Palestinian Authority Security Forces in blue vests and then have a helmet with as well, so we could see them at the same exact locations that the Shireen Abu Akleh was at. And from 190 meters away, we could clearly see just with our plain eyes that this was a blue vest and a blue helmet. From there, we looked and did a straight line trajectory, utilizing some capabilities to see exactly how the angles of the shots would have gone from where they were at. And then also with an optic to see how clearly we'd be able to see that the individual was wearing a blue vest that would have said media and a blue helmet. So after we conducted that analysis, we were able to disprove very quickly the assertion that there was a Palestinian gunman in front of Shireen Abu Akleh that the IDF had shot at, and they had accidentally shot her instead for multiple reasons. One, the actual shots, if they were shooting at a Palestinian gunman where they said they were at, based upon the elevation change and the distance, the bullets would have hit about 75 to 100 meters in front of Shireen Abu Akleh. So there's no way that could have happened. And then when we look at the angle trajectory of where they were shot from, the vehicle that the sniper would have been in with a scope and with the basically a fixed position as the barrel actually goes out through the door and you can turn it around and move it, so it's a stable firing position. The shots were directly angled at where they hit the tree and at Shireen Abu Akleh from that location. With the unit itself, it was the Dudevan unit, which is a special operations counter-terror unit, highly trained and highly skilled. So we knew also definitively that the person who would have been conducting the security on both sides were trained and operational in that unit, and also that the unit has excellent optics that they utilize on their weapons. At a minimum, it would be an ACOG. Could have been any other type of scope as well. We do not know. The Israelis never gave us that information. So after we gathered all this up, the indications of everything we read, you know, from the reports that we got from the IDF on their locations and proximity to where the event happened, what we got from the investigation from the Palestinian Authority and our investigation, to us it was very clear that the individual in the vehicle who took the shots, and it was one individual, would have had a clear line of sight and would have had visibility of Shireen Abu Akleh walking down the middle of the street for a period of time before he took the shots. Even one of the examples they said from the IDF, well, you know, it was a rapid thing. They were responding to other fires. You know, they didn't see the target on, you know, they did not see Shireen Abu Akleh as a potential media person because it was so rapid. That's, you know, is dispelled also by the fact that there was the break after he already taken aim and hit Al-Samoudi, and then subsequently took aim shots then. So no matter what, they would have had the scope and optic down the road by the time Shireen Abu Akleh was shot. And they were in clear view in the middle of the road.
Did the Israeli military, did the Israeli government allow you to question the Israeli military?
No, they did not. The only thing that we got was them giving us the initial report of their operations that day, which basically just laid out what they were doing and their timeline and where the forces were at. This was also at the same point in time that they were saying that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't us, it was a Palestinian gunman, and if it was us by any chance, it was an absolute accident. Never would have known that she was actually there, and we did not try to shoot her. Now, I believe they didn't know that it was Shireen Abu Akleh. I think they knew she was in the area, but they would have known as a journalist for sure. tied to that also just very quickly. So one of the pieces that sort of drove the U.S. perspective on this was that Major General Fuchs, who was the Central Command commander, on the same very same day Shireen Abu-Akleh was shot, May 11th, he met with Lieutenant General Fenzel and basically sketched out, you know, where his forces were and said that it was most likely a Palestinian who had shot her, but there was a possibility that it could have been an accidental shooting based upon the fog of war from the IDF. And that's pretty much the stance that the, you know, the USG sort of stayed with in spite of all the evidence that transpired after that first day.
So then if you can talk about what was said at the time, at the conclusion of the report. I want to go to the Zatayo documentary, Who Killed Shireen, in which Diane Nissenbaum speaks with the former State Department official Andrew Miller, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Israeli-Palestinian Affairs when Shireen was killed in 2022.
It's nearly 100% certain that an Israeli soldier, likely a sniper, fired the shot that killed, or the shots that killed Shireen Abu-Akleh. Based on all the information we have, it is not credible to suggest that there were targets either in front of or behind Shireen Abu-Akleh. The fact that the official Israeli position remains that this was a case of crossfire. The entire episode was a mistake, as opposed to potentially a mistaken identification or the deliberate targeting of this individual, points to, I think, a broader policy of seeking to manage the narrative.
And did these Israelis ever make the soldier available to the U.S. to talk about it?
No. And the Israelis were not willing to present that person for even informal questioning.
So that is the former State Department official, Andrew Miller. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Israeli-Palestinian Affairs when Shireen was killed back in May 2022, not to be confused with Matthew Miller. And we want to play a clip from him from last year under President Biden. A reporter is questioning the State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller.
I'm asking, like, why USA in, like, didn't take Aisha Nouri case and Shireen Abu-Akleh case seriously and suspended military aid to Israel.
We have taken those cases.
And they are American.
We have taken those cases extremely seriously. If you heard me yesterday when I talked at this podium, I talked at length about our interactions with the government of Israel about most recently the Aisha Nouri Egi case, where we have made clear to them that her death was unacceptable, that it should have been avoided, it should have never happened in the first place, that we want to see the results of their investigation and we want to see them change their rules of engagement.
So that was Matthew Miller. If you can explain your response, I think the term was flabbergasted. A number of the people engaged in this investigation, like you were, retired colonel, explain what exactly the responses of the State Department, their conclusions that this was tragic circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll actually back it up a little bit because it ties very well into the comments from Andrew Miller as well. So after we had completed this, we were on regular video calls, classified and unclassified, with the State Department. I spoke with Andrew Miller several times about our findings. I spoke to Ambassador Nides about my findings as well. And I indicated to both of them in different times that the evidence to me indicated that there would have been enough if we actually built a criminal case to have enough information and facts to be beyond a reasonable doubt for a conviction at some level would be manslaughter or something of that nature. So that was briefed to both the ambassador, to General Fenzel, and then also to, you know, the State Department during these different engagements. So that's one reason why, you know, I've worked very closely with Andrew Miller since that point in time as well. So we were anticipating and we were pushing for the fact that they needed to formally admit the fact that it was not an accident, that a soldier killed Shireen Abu-Akleh, that it was an intentional shooting. And unfortunately, that was not what came out on July 4th. I had been going back and forth predominantly with Lieutenant General Fenzel and saying, we need to make this and hold them accountable for their actions. We need the Biden administration to absolutely press Israel to follow through on this and give us answers for the killing of an American citizen, where all evidence indicates that it was an intentional thing. And we saw you know, the false narratives that Israel was trying to press continuously, all the way until September of actually 2022, when they finally admitted that it was the IDF that likely killed her, but still as an accident. So when the actual statement came out on July 4th, that was absolutely not what I expected. I know General Fenzel had been involved in writing that statement. I was not involved in the final component of the statement that was written for the State Department to release on July 4th, so I was shocked. Sitting there with several other members of our team, with the public diplomacy team at the Office of Palestinian Affairs as well, and we couldn't understand what actually happened. We're like, how can we even possibly say this? Number one, there's still data out there. All the data indicates the exact opposite. It was not fog of war. There was no way there was any, you know, Palestinian gunmen in the way or anything else that would go to the Israeli narrative. So when that came out, it's like, took the sails out of us, because this was not what we had found. And this continued to be a point of contention for me for the next 2 years as the report was written with the findings for the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Would you call this a cover-up by the Biden administration?
Definitely a lack of action. Cover-up? Maybe to a degree. Yes, because many people knew within there and had the ability to reach out and find all the rest of the information from us and chose not to after that narrative was said. So the fact that initially Biden came out and said when it was a Palestinian gunman, what was thought to be a Palestinian gunman, that we will find who this was, we will make sure there's justice for the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh. But then after that statement came out on July 4th, we never heard anything again from the administration whatsoever to hold Israel accountable for anything. And once there was no Palestinian gunman, they weren't after looking to find an answer for who actually killed her. So in that sense, it was an inaction, cover-up to some degree, and it all came down to, in my mind, not trying to anger the Israelis by holding them accountable for intentionally killing an American citizen.
You would later retire from the State Department. You went unidentified in the Who Killed Shireen Zateo documentary. Why have you decided to come out fully now, identifying yourself and speaking out?
So while I was still in the military prior to January, I couldn't really speak out about this. Not tied to being secret or anything of that nature, but just within the context of being within the military, I would have to listen to the directives of the public affairs and everything else and what they would allow me to talk about or not talk about. So after I retired, this had, like I said, remained on my conscience continuously. And a friend of mine introduced me to Dion, and we talked, and we agreed that I would participate in the documentary. I had been, you know, concerned to a degree about coming forward because potential ramifications, both personally, you know, from threats and everything else that could possibly come from it. But after the documentary came out, I was looking to come forward in about the May-June time frame. And that's when I decided I need to keep this going. I need to talk about it, because what we need to have happen is there needs to be action taken. We cannot let our American citizens be killed anywhere around the country, around the world, without someone taking action and actually look into it and hold people accountable for it. So I figured that the best way for me to do this and try to prevent that from happening again to journalists, to other American citizens, whatever it may be, is we have to keep this on the, you know, on the news cycle, in the discussions with congressional leaders, in discussions, you know, with the White House for what has to be done. And when I also saw what the current administration is doing in holding people accountable globally, which I very much appreciated compared to what the Biden administration did, I thought there's a hope also that we might be able to have additional pressure and efforts to hold Israel accountable for what they've done, not only just with, you know, Shirin Abu Akleh. We also had another American killed literally that same year in January in the hands of the IDF. And then, of course, we had an American citizen who was killed by settlers with IDF presence in July. So we have to make sure that this stuff is being dealt with seriously. That's why I wanted to come out and be a voice for the protection of Americans.
Retired Colonel Steve Gabovich, I want to thank you for being with us when the U.S. officials closely examining the May 11, 2022 Israeli military shooting death of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. He concluded her killing was intentional. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a man who's being described as the Mandani of the Midwest, Omar Fateh, the son of Somali immigrants, Democratic socialists seeking to unseat the incumbent Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey. Back in 20 seconds. Once I had a dream that made me sad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. As voters cast early ballots ahead of Election Day this coming Tuesday, we end today's show with the mayoral race in Minneapolis. Omar Fateh, the son of Somali immigrants, a Democratic socialist, is a leading candidate seeking to unseat incumbent mayor Jacob Frey, who's running for a third term. In 2020, Fateh made history as the first Muslim, first Somali-American to be elected to Minnesota's state Senate. Fateh's surging campaign has drawn comparisons to Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic socialist, who polls indicate may be the first Muslim mayor of New York. Minneapolis Congressmember Ilhan Omar has endorsed Fateh, along with Jewish Voice for Peace Action and labor unions like SEIU. Minneapolis implemented ranked choice voting in 2009, which allows voters to choose up to three candidates in order of preference on their ballot. The winning candidate must receive at least half the vote. There are a total of 15 mayoral candidates on the ballot, with four Democrats, including the two frontrunners, Mayor Jacob Frey and Omar Fateh. Fateh is the only top candidate who's asked voters not to rank Frey, a centrist who's faced widespread criticism over his crackdown on Black Lives Matter protesters following the police murder of George Floyd in 2020. Frey has received the endorsement of Minnesota Governor, failed vice presidential candidate Tim Walz. Minnesota State Senator and Minneapolis mayoral candidate Omar Fateh joins us now. We welcome you to Democracy Now! If you can start off by talking about what the slate is that you are a part of, for people to understand around the country this issue of ranked choice voting and what you're moving forward on now, your major issues.
Yeah, first, thank you for having me. So we came up with the Slate for Change, myself, candidate Janice Hampton, and candidate Duane Davis, because we believe it's the best, we are the best three candidates to move our city forward. We came together around our collective vision, and yet despite our differences, showing that Minneapolis can have a different kind of politics where if you think differently, if you have slight differences in opinion around different issues, that we shouldn't have an adversarial relationship, and that we can still be partners and doing the work for our people, for the people of Minneapolis. And so my vision includes one in which we make Minneapolis a more affordable city, increasing the minimum wage to $20 an hour, passing rent stabilization to protect our renters so that they don't get priced out. It includes having a public safety system that reflects the needs of everyone. 5 years after the murder of George Floyd, the mayor doesn't have a plan or doesn't intend to have a plan. And finally, we have a hostile federal government with Trump back in office, who has the trifecta. He has both the House and the Senate and the presidency. And on top of that, he has a Supreme Court that's going to do and has been doing whatever he wants. And so as a city, we need to build a strong line of defense to protect all of our vulnerable residents.
How do you feel, Omar Fateh, about being called the Mamdani of the Midwest? And one of the issues that Zohran Mamdani raises in this New York mayoral race is the issue of big money. If you can also talk about the role of big money in your mayoral race, PACs protecting the interests of developers and funneling millions of dollars into campaigns, and your chief rival, Mayor Frey.
Yeah, what we're seeing with Zohran's campaign and campaigns across the nation is that we're seeing progressive candidates running on a sincere and authentic message around affordability and making the lives of working families better. For far too long, the Democratic Party has lost the message around how to improve the lives around the costs of living, around renters that are struggling with paycheck to paycheck, struggling to make the next month's rent, struggling to pay for basic food and healthcare costs. And so this is kind of the reason why we saw a hard swing in 2024 with Trump winning the presidency. And now candidates on the left or in the Democratic Party winning with a similar message around affordability. Now, was Trump lying when he was running? 100%, of course he was. But he knew that that was a message that would resonate the most with the population. And so right now what we're seeing here in Minneapolis is that Mayor Fry has five PACs right now. Not one, not two, but five PACs that have been well-funded, that have been sending out glossy mailers, nonstop ads on social media and on YouTube and things like that. And the reality is that if an incumbent has been doing the on-the-ground work, connecting with residents, connecting with stakeholders, working well with city council and cross-jurisdictionally across different levels of government, there wouldn't be the need to spend that much money and having five different PACs to defend you. It's very telling that right now that the mayor doesn't have a single county endorsement, county commissioner endorsement, or state legislator endorsement. And it's because he hasn't been able to work well with others and has handed the city off in his last two terms to the wealthy and the well-connected and not the working families. And so that has been evident throughout this campaign.
State Senator, your headquarters, your campaign headquarters for mayor in the predominantly East African neighborhood of Cedar Riverside in Minneapolis was vandalized with graffiti that read, "Somali Muslim, this warning is no joke," in black marker. You're certainly not the only Muslim politician to receive these threats in Minnesota and nationwide. I think about Ilhan Omar, who has also endorsed you, the Congress member from Minneapolis. But can you talk about the rise of anti-Muslim hate, racism in the country? And do you think the Democratic Party and other Democratic candidates and politicians are pushing back hard enough?
Well, what we are seeing here in Minnesota, I believe, is a direct result of our welcoming, the way we welcome everyone, and the way we uplift everyone. And what I mean by that is that we were the first state to have a Muslim congressman in Keith Ellison. We were the first state to have a Muslim congresswoman in Ilhan Omar, who has been serving honorably and serving CD5 and has been a rock star for all of us and a voice that we truly, truly needed. What we're seeing in the last few years is that I think since 2024, there has been over a dozen instances of attacks on mosques, for example. Minnesota has had, I believe, the first and only mosque being bombed in the entire nation. Over $3 million in damages, three mosques fully burned to the ground. Myself and other Muslim elected officials have been receiving threats on email and social media.
We have 20 seconds.
Yes, and through social media. And so the rise in hate we've been seeing has been a direct result of also Trump being elected. But in terms of campaigns, we've seen also Democratic campaigns latch onto this and use it in their own messaging and through their PACs to try to win their elections. And so rather than going on the defense for one another, they've been using it to sow more hate.
Well, I want to thank you, Omar Fateh, for joining us. Democratic Socialist Minnesota State Senator, Minneapolis mayoral candidate. The election is Tuesday.
Broadcasting on the Internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.